I mean, I did tell you that I was making fun of a girl that I like that would read the books, and I kept telling her I was gonna write a book set in the same universe called Werewolves Doing It, written by Stephen Meyer. I would plot it out for her at work and everything.
At the time, that would have been like a joke, but in like a 50 Shades world, like anything goes. Another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. Portland, Oregon is where you live. My co-host, Richard Wally.
That wasn't an active sentence, Cassidy. Cassidy Robinson, you are from L.A. That isn't either. I think I fucked that up. I did. Well, I mean, that's the thing, too, is like when you like listen to people speak, I would have so many conjunctions and commas in bad places, and it'd be a mess.
Transcribe interviews every once in a while. Like not super often because it's boring and nobody wants to do it, but every once in a while I would do that. And I would try and type it out exactly like how the person said it. So if they like began to say something and then like midway through their sentence like changed, like started over again.
Right.
I would add like ellipses and that kind of stuff.
Right. Also, there'd be a lot of parentheses. I do a lot of asides. So it would be bad. So
it essentially read like a run-on sentence, like a William Burroughs novel or something.
Right.
But he made a lot of money, so there you go. Maybe, or did he? I don't know. That's probably not true.
That's probably not true. No, not Burroughs.
He did a lot of heroin. That's for sure.
We know that. We know that for sure. I think he did okay. He did like okay nominally. I mean, he didn't die of hunger or anything.
No.
Because he did a lot of heroin.
All right. This is getting weird already.
Yeah, I like it.
Today we're going to be reviewing Deadpool in our main review. And then at the end of the episode for our Netflix homework, we're still going to do 30 for 30 Broke, which was the review we were supposed to do with a friend of the show, Patrick, from Make Dad Read Comics. He was unable to make it today. You know, family crisis kind of situation. So we're going to carry on. I went to Deadpool, you know, I'm a sort of a nervous and paranoid person.
All the time. Yes.
Generally speaking. Yeah. I'm in some sort of crisis either, you know, inside my head or in reality.
Mostly in your head. Let's be honest. Lions have never attacked you that I'm aware of.
One day, Richard.
I know. I shouldn't tell you that, should I?
Did I tell you that that is actually like a reoccurring dream I have?
No.
I haven't in a long time. But when I was a kid, a reoccurring nightmare I would have is that there was a lion that would be like a big, you know, Aslan looking lion that'd be like wandering.
It was Aslan, wasn't it?
No, because he's benevolent and, you know, he's Jesus.
Evil Aslan.
No.
Evil Aslan, Jesus tiger. I mean, lion.
But I would have these dreams where a gigantic male lion is just like circling the house. And I wouldn't be able to leave. And I would have to like, you know, hold the doors closed while he's trying to claw through. It was a weird reoccurring dream I had for a long time. Anyway.
Yeah. Talking about parentheses and asides. Go on.
So it's happened a few times where people have brought weapons into theaters and unloaded on the crowd. And, you know, so that's just one of many things I have to worry about all the time. And usually I don't think about it, but every once in a while I'll see somebody who has like a full on duffel bag or a backpack. Like, I understand like ladies who need like a big bag so that they can carry their things, or if they have like infants or whatever and they have to carry their infant stuff. How in this day and age are people still getting into theaters with duffel bags and backpacks?
Well, I mean, how are you going to get your 6 foot, you know, sub in there?
Exactly. I feel like, I mean, so I was sitting next to a guy who seemed nice enough. And, you know, I'm alive, so he was nice. But he was a little weird. He was kind of twitchy, you know, like he was there by himself. He wasn't there with people. I was there by myself, too. So he probably thought I was weird. But, yeah. You know, I was just kind of sitting there, like, watching, like, the redundant Eminem commercial that they show every single time I go to the movies. And all of a sudden, he just started, like, scratching his face a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of just, like, getting really jittery. And then that's when I noticed he had, like, a big, like, open backpack at his feet. And so immediately, I'm, like, eyeing the exits and, like, planning my escape route.
Sure.
Like,
sure.
Okay, if he pulls an Uzi out, like, what do I do? So I think my plan would be is I was close enough that if I got a glimpse of what he was doing fast enough, I could maybe hit the deck, grab him by the feet, and pull him down. He was a short guy.
That's a sort of silly, but go on.
He was a short guy.
Why the feet?
Because I would try to destabilize him.
That's the weakness of short people.
Right. Because, well, if I tried to, like, attack him at the face or, like, the shoulder or something like that, then he would be eye level and he could shoot me. But if I grab him at the feet and put him down, then it would not only destabilize him, he'd be less likely to, like, gun down anybody else.
Okay.
So that was my escape route. But the real reason I wanted to bring this up is, what is the deal with people bringing in backpacks and duffel bags and, like, these ushers just being like, okay, go ahead?
Well, they're 20 nothings. They're not paid well. And
still, I just think that, like, at this point of time, that should be like a given. Be like, I'm sorry, you can't come in with that. You're going to have to put that in your car.
I don't think you're wrong. If people took public transportation, that would be one reason they have a backpack if they're coming from work, that kind of thing.
Then they should ask to leave it in the box office or something.
No, I again, I don't think you're wrong, but I mean, I'm just saying why it happens. You asked me why. I gave you the obvious answers.
It's not a good enough answer, Richard. You need to get on top of this.
The movie theater system is failing you.
Mm-hmm.
It's leading to your further paranoia, being gunned down by short people. So you attack them at the feet.
Only if I'm sitting right next to them. My plan, if I'm not sitting close enough, is in the haze of bullets, if I don't get, you know, rained down on first.
Push the nearest person in front of them.
No, yeah. I'm not a human shield. I would just get down and play dead.
That's actually not bad. Yeah. I like that plan much, much better than attacking the person's feet. Are you saying you're going to, like, sweep the feet? Is this like
I would get down and grab them by the ankles and yank them down. That was the plan.
Why don't you just tackle them?
Well, that's essentially like a tackle. It's just a better tackle than trying to do it by the shoulders where I'm at eye level with their gun.
Or they kick you in the face and then they shoot you in the head while you're on the ground.
Only I would have to do it really fast.
Like, I'm sorry.
I would essentially have to go for it as he was, like, you know, the first glimpse of a weapon I could see.
You should just run.
Let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
Yeah, let's not depress people more.
I'll do this one. Johnny Depp has been set to star in Universal's reboot of The Invisible Man, which is set to be written by Ed Solomon, who wrote Men in Black. So there you go. This is the, we've talked about this a little bit before. This is going to be part of the Universal's attempt to create a movie universe based upon the old Universal classics, talking about those.
Well, what's funny is specifically, but what I was thinking of when you said that, I was like, yeah, they're not sure when they're going to start it because they keep releasing them and say, this is going to be part of the Universal, like, world. And then it's not a part of the Universal movies, they decide. It's like, let's just everybody forget. If we go a couple years, everybody will forget.
Right. Specifically.
The world will not forget Luke Evans as Dracula. The world will not forget.
Where does... You know, you say you watch these movies quite often. Where does Invisible Man rank as far as Universal movies go?
Well, I always have to draw, like, a dichotomy between, like, my favorite and the best.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that the Invisible Man, like the original Invisible Man, is one of the best done of the Universal horror movies.
Yeah.
Favorite, though, it's kind of down there, you know? He's just an invisible guy. But, I mean, it's done really well. And I mean, for the time, if you're talking about effects and things like that, it's done pretty... I mean, you see it, and it seems realistic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Even from a 1930s kind of effects standard. I mean, they kind of devolve into, like, Invisible Agent.
Yeah, it like gets goofy.
Yeah, he goes to World War II. Well, that's what I'm talking about. There's that post-World War before America gets into the war, and then there's the during the war. And then later on, you get into, like, Creature of the Black Lagoon and nuclear kind of fear and stuff like that. Huh. But specifically the Invisible Man, it's one of the better acted and one of the... They have this really silly character in it, though. Parentheses within parentheses.
Well, how do you feel about Johnny Depp in the lead?
I never know how to feel about Johnny Depp in anything anymore.
That's true.
He could be really great, and I could see him portraying it well, or he could be fucking the Mad Hatter. I don't know. What Johnny Depp are we getting? Are they going to put him in some weird prosthetics, and he's going to be like Irish Dracula?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he's already played a vampire, so now he can play the Invisible Man.
And we're not even talking about that Tim Burton movie he was just in.
Oh, yeah. The Dark Shadows.
Yeah, we're talking about Black Mass still.
Well, certainly falls into his wheelhouse as far as his, you know, celebrity brand goes.
Did it say who's going to be doing it officially, like directing?
I don't think there's anyone signed on to direct yet. It says here, the actor has signed on to star in The Invisible Man, the studio's latest offering being developed by producers Alex Kurtzman and Chris Morgan. The studio has a writer's room with elite scribes Kurtzman and Morgan, blah, 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 blah. Ed Solomon, who wrote Men in Black, is going to be co-writing it. Yeah, I don't think there is a director attached just yet.
Well, see, that's, I guess, maybe partially the problem. If we're saying Ed Solomon, mm-hmm. you know, we're saying Men in Black, Now You See Me. Those movies are fun, tentpole, blockbustery...
Yeah.
Nothings. They're just entertainment.
Right.
The original Invisible Man had, you know, it was kind of like saying if we gave this person this power, even this very, I mean, right now we would like roll our eyes. Oh, he can just go invisible. But if you think about the things you could get away with if you did that, you know, it talked a lot about the power of corruption.
Right.
And how power corrupts. I am going to say that it's leaning more towards Invisible Agent kind of territory.
Given the writer and given the team behind it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't know where they're going with it. I mean, they already did kind of. It's largely people don't talk about it, but it's Paul Verhoeven, the RoboCop guy.
Yeah,
He did Hollow Man. Hollow Man was a semi-version of that where he was kind of date rapey as the Invisible Man.
Yeah, so. I saw that. You know, Paul Verhoeven, he's had kind of a hit or miss career as it is. That's not a very good movie.
I don't remember. I remember liking it at the time, but I was also in like, I don't know, like, I want to say fifth grade.
Oh, but we were older than that.
Were we older?
Okay. Yeah, I want to say like eighth grade.
Oh, could be. I still liked it, but...
No, yeah, I you know, there was nudity and all the stuff you can expect from a Paul Verhoeven movie. I just, I remember it feeling, I don't know, maybe I'd like it more now. Who knows?
Well, he is kind of he is one of those directors that you kind of have to look at, like, as an adult. I don't know what Universal's plan is. I mean, they make Fast and the Furious. That's what they want to make out of these.
Yeah, I don't know. I will see if they can get it off the ground. It's going to take at least one or two very successful movies to make this whole universe thing work out. But mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, if their idea is take a star and plug them in, that hasn't been necessarily that. Because I know that they want to put Tom Cruise in The Mummy, mm-hmm. I believe is the movie that they're sticking him into. So if that's their plan, I guess we'll see where it goes.
Yeah, I think they're banking on the star. And that, remember when Benicio del Toro was Wolfman?
Yeah, I remember that. That came and went.
Sure.
And they had a lot of the same thing about that movie is Universal. They got involved a lot in that movie, and that's one of the reasons they cite for the problems with it. That's hearsay. I don't know, but what I'm saying, but it doesn't. I don't know. Looking at their current, how they're looking at them, nothing about this bodes well.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think there's too few details here to really be able to say much. I'd like to be able to know who's going to direct it. That would give me some confidence, but
My first story is about that little indie movie Star Wars, Episode 8. It's going well. What they've already started shooting it. That's already started happening. But they've continued a little bit with some casting notes. And this is actually news. So we're going to talk about the two people they cast with Laura Dern and Benicio del Toro have joined the cast, as well as the ones that were already in the movie. Both great actors.
Yeah.
So what that adds, I'm not sure. Other than we already know it was pretty fun. I like Rian Johnson. So do you have a specific take on this? I was just like, oh, cool.
Does it say in the article what they're going to be? I'm sure it doesn't.
It just says they were confirmed on Monday.
Right, yeah. I think their approach to this rebooted series is smart in that, you know, rather than finding Hayden Christensen's out there to play these parts, pad out these, could be smaller parts, could be bigger parts, we don't know, but pad them out with professional actor-y actors.
Well, they're kind of trying to go more the Alec Guinness route with some of their sides. And Benicio del Toro and Laura Dern are definitely within that range. So I think it helps the younger actors that they do bring in, I can't remember their names now. Those young kids they brought in. But to have them alongside an older, more seasoned cast, I think it really does help. It helps just bring up the whole thing. It is brought up that there was a rumor a long time ago that Benicio del Toro was being rumored for some kind of villainous role within Star Wars. But this was when they were casting for Episode 7.
What would you do if he was playing the same part that he played in the Guardians of the Galaxy?
The Collector? Yeah.
And it was... And then all of a sudden that that one filibuster scene from Parks and Rec with Patton Oswalt,
okay,
like that started to come to fruition.
Well, I used to joke about it, I always used to joke about all the movies should be connected. And one of my first sources on that was the black dad from Family Matters, I believe it is. The one with Urkel.
Because
he's also in Die Hard and Ghostbusters, and he's always a cop in all of those. I said that would be the one link in. If that actually does happen, I would be kind of sad because that would mean my silly joke became reality. And then because I've made a horrible thing happen in the world.
You've become too powerful.
I've become too powerful, yes.
I don't know. I'm excited to see what the series has in store. I was pleasantly surprised by the quality of the last Star Wars film, and there's going to be a bunch of side movies and this and that, and it's going to splinter off into 1,000 different directions, and who knows what the quality upkeep is going to be as far as that goes. But I'm into those actors, and I'd be into seeing what they bring to it.
Yeah,
let's go ahead and get into our review, The Big Kahuna. Our main review for Deadpool. I just wanted to see if this director had done anything before, and he has not.
No.
He was an action.
He did stunts and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And action coordinator films or something like that.
Yeah. So this is directed by Tim Miller. This is his debut film. He stunt coordinator for some action films, and he's also done a few shorts, but this is his first main movie. This is based upon the Marvel comic book character Deadpool, who's sort of a cult favorite. He was invented by Rob Liefeld in the early 90s, and he's, I don't know, he's kind of invented to be cool, I think.
Well, he was literally a Deathstroke, like, ripoff, and then the writer was like, this is a Deathstroke ripoff. They're like, well, yeah. And then they just started turning him into a joke. I mean, I think his first couple of appearances were pretty dead serious.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime after that, he became the sillier character that he's become.
Yeah, sillier and sillier. And writers have been able to do a lot with the character because one of the things that's sort of well known about him as a comic book entity is that he can break the fourth wall. He can call, specifically speak to the readers. He can call out the world as being phony, or as being, talking about the writing itself. And, so it ends up becoming this kind of deconstruction of the comic book, sort of postmodern smirkiness. And they've really went all in with this movie with that tone.
Well, it was also written by Rhett Reese and Paul Wynrick, the guys from Zombieland.
So yes.
That kind of tells you a little something as well.
Yeah, which was, that movie was a little self-referential as well. And you can feel their influence, especially dialogue sequences and that kind of stuff. And, Ryan Reynolds plays the lead here as Deadpool, and this is not the first time he's played Deadpool.
Very different the last time, but that's a film different. They make fun of that movie several times throughout. So if you are a big fan of all the comic book movies, you can kind of pick them out, but it's not necessarily essential to the viewing.
No, certainly not. But if people may recall that Ryan Reynolds played Deadpool in the X-Men Origins Wolverine movie, which is abysmal.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Pretty bad. But I think a lot of people, who saw that movie were okay with like the first 15 minutes.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And Ryan Reynolds, was doing a good Deadpool in that first 15 minutes, being really jokey and, he kind of fit the part. And
One of his monikers or whatever is the Merc with a Mouth.
Right.
And it's a joke per minute kind of book. I mean, breaking the fourth wall, a lot of times that's what it's used for more than anything else, is just to say a silly little joke.
Right. The basic story here is an origin story. They completely throw out the X-Men origin stuff, which, thank God. Yes. But, mostly this is an origin story of how Deadpool came to be. We see him in the beginning sort of on a revenge trip. He's in a cab and he's about to take down a bunch of other mercenaries with superpowers, and some of which who do not have superpowers. And then from that scene, it kind of goes back and flashback and back and forth, catching us up to the present time with how he became Deadpool, why he becomes Deadpool, and the people he meets along the way. And I have to say, I was surprised by how okay I was with this movie.
Yeah, you're usually not I was curious, because you usually don't like when a movie jumps back and forth like that. Usually.
No, I don't have a problem. I don't have a problem with non-linear storytelling, and I think in the case of this film, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a little bit of that in Zombieland as well.
Well, with origin stories, I actually think they should do this more often,
mm-hmm.
so that we can just not have to get the full origin.
Right, and we do get the full origin. I mean, I think that is the primary story, but we also get Deadpool being Deadpool throughout. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So you don't. It's not just like the last 15 minutes and he's finally in the costume and whatever, but. And why I was surprised that I liked the movie is because I was annoyed as shit by the marketing of this movie.
Okay.
Every poster I saw, every trailer I saw, I just thought, oh, God, I don't know if this is going to be for me. It looks so self-satisfied and smug and juvenile and stupid.
And it largely was, but in a
it
good
is
way.
All of those things. Yeah. But weirdly enough, when you see it in the context of a film, and it's not just like a overbearing marketing campaign, and keep in mind, I live in Los Angeles, where even like the fourth tier movie that's coming out that weekend is being shoved down your throat.
I could see that. That's an interesting perspective. I felt that way too, but that was just the online ads shoving it down my throat. I wasn't outside, and somebody handed me a flyer that says go to Deadpool or we'll murder your cat or anything like that.
Well, there wasn't that. I mean, short of that, I had about everything else. But this is also a big, I think part of the narrative of the success of this film, because it's supposedly like the highest opening R-rated film for February or something like that. I think part of the narrative of that is its marketing campaign, and specifically its online marketing campaign. I think there is like marketing awards like Oscars. These guys, whoever the team behind it, should get something, because I'm guaranteed that that's the only reason this movie did as well as it did. I mean, it has a fan base within the comic book world, no doubt. Mm-hmm. But this character, you know, is, I wouldn't say obscure. People kind of know who he is, but he isn't a box office opener kind of thing. And now
a lot of the box office like movies anymore aren't. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, basically, like when this all started, the superhero boom, and we talk about this sporadically because it's a thing.
Yeah,
it was pretty much Spider-Man and X-Men were your guys. Mm-hmm. The fact that now a movie called, you know, starring Deadpool is a thing, it's pretty crazy.
So, what did you think of it?
I mean, I had some reservations just because I wasn't sure, because Fox has a. Mine was more reservations because Fox has a habit of making bad movies.
Their reputation is spotty at best. I think that's the X-Men's are kind of hot and cold, and then a lot of the side stuff is less so.
It's just bad, yeah. Well, it's the okay. That takes a whole kind of other side route. But Deadpool specifically, I enjoyed it. It is some of the things you said. It is juvenile. It is kind of sophomoric. But I think in a fun way. If you don't like that kind of stuff, you're not going to like this film. But if you're okay with that kind of humor and anything goes, I will say that about the movie. One thing, if you are a Deadpool fan, most of the Deadpool stuff is like PG, like 15, 16, something like that. You know, it doesn't go as risque as this movie goes. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because honestly, this movie has a lot more personality than a lot of superhero movies. And that's, I think, to me, actually, is largely why it works. It's just because you don't see a lot of rated R superhero movies, period. I think, you know,
let alone rated R superhero comedies.
Yeah. And also, well, comedies. And also, like, they usually go, they tend to skew more serious. But I mean, it's like Kick-Ass. And then the Blade movies, and I don't know, maybe Punisher, I guess. I think that's about it. So just in that sense, it just felt good. It's like, oh, okay, we can be this kind of thing. But specifically, Deadpool was built to be, you know, a funny joke a minute, rated R kind of movie. I think it works. It fills out good. Even for a first-time director, I think that a lot of it, especially kind of with the non-linear storytelling, is pretty solid for... Mm-hmm. Maybe that's based on a good script. Either way, it works. I enjoy most of the cast. So one thing, I guess, that I'm kind of curious to see what happens if we're talking about a character that's in it named Colossus.
Right.
He is a cartoony, kind of sillier version. And if he showed up in an X-Men movie, I would be like, that's lame. Because I really like Colossus as a character. Mm-hmm. So this kind of stunted cartoon version of, you know, well, is good for what it is. But if it expanded to other movies, I would be a little...
Well, it's interesting how this movie tries to tie into the X-Men franchise.
Right.
It's the character that is fighting alongside Colossus, this like girl with a buzz cut. Is she a thing?
I had to actually, it's not somebody I knew, but when I looked it up, she is a side character.
Okay.
A super side character that just, they stole the moniker, the name from, and then they kind of created somebody around her.
Okay, so which is Fox has done multiple times in the X-Men universe. Yeah, that's not uncommon for them. But, you know, I think the two of them play out fine. And I think that, yes, the tone, the way using Colossus as a foil for Deadpool and kind of this almost sort of comedic duo, although they don't completely commit to that. But, you know, he has a certain tone for the movie that is basically there to make Deadpool look funnier, give him punchlines and that kind of stuff.
He's the straight man with the silly accent. Yes.
Right, right, right. But I feel like you could take that character as portrayed in this movie, and you could pivot that a little in a more serious X-Men movie and without having to create a wildly different character. I think, you know, honestly, the comics do that. That's more than anything what really kind of surprised me about this Deadpool movie, mostly because it does come out of 20th Century Fox, who has always been very liberal with the interpretation of their comic book properties. This one, they pretty much just did Deadpool.
Right, and they try to stay to the spirit of Deadpool.
Yeah, they didn't mess with it that much. The origin story is probably a little cobbled, but it's, you know, for the most part, it feels exactly like what it would feel like to read a Deadpool comic. I could see myself reading exactly this.
This story. Well, I think that the storyline, I haven't read the origin, so I don't know, but I'm thinking that it's pretty close to the actual one. Mm-hmm. I know. Well, what's kind of interesting too is they make pretty interesting, because first of all, they make a Spider-Man reference, and they have a bat, like one of the big set pieces. This isn't like a spoiler or anything, is set on a helicarrier.
Yeah.
And those were just things that I was like, well, what are they doing here exactly? And I don't mind that. It lets me make believe that, you know, they're actually going to tie this all together. They're not going to, but
no, well,
especially with how much money this made.
Right. At least not yet. But, you know, now that the Sony gave away Spider-Man, you know, the door has been open to the possibilities of franchise sharing and that kind of stuff. But right.
There's a precedence for it now.
Right. I think that Deadpool, as it stands, as a movie on its own, even if you don't get all the references, I think actually this has a strangely wider appeal than maybe even a lot of like Marvel comic book stuff, because those movies are, you know, for the most part, playing it straight. They might have jokes and, you know, that kind of stuff, but it is the Marvel universe as is written, whereas this movie is so comedically driven and so violent and, you know, so self-referential. And, you know, I could see a person who generally doesn't care for comic book movies maybe being able to find their way in on this one.
Like, maybe, yeah, somebody, I could see that too.
I could also see somebody hating this movie.
Well, yeah.
For all the reasons I said before. And I think that that would be valid. I wouldn't say that that person is not getting it or whatever. I think that the tone of this movie is pretty bratty and, like I said, pretty self-satisfied. So I think that if that's not your thing, if you've never found Ryan Reynolds to be even remotely funny, and he is one of those actors that people kind of are hot or cold on, I don't think this movie is going to be for you.
But saying that, I think it does tap into Ryan Reynolds, like, the thing about, like, a lot of Ryan Reynolds' performances is usually because, like, everything is PG-13. He can't really go full. And Ryan Reynolds actually has a really perverted, kind of witty, sick tongue, double entendre kind of stuff. And so the character, so him being able to be let free in this movie, I was like, oh, yeah, this is why we liked Ryan Reynolds at first. Like, oh, he can be that guy. He doesn't have to be, you know, shoved into some PG-13 blockbuster and not really be able to be fully himself.
Right.
Like, this feels a little bit more like, oh, this is Ryan Reynolds. He likes to play kind of sleazy characters. That's interesting. Mm-hmm.
I was also really surprised that the slight, it's not a lot, but the slight amount of animation they do on his face.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when I saw that in the trailer, I thought that was really going to be distracting and annoying. I got used to it pretty quickly. Yeah, like, they animate the eyes so that it has more expression.
I thought you meant, okay, when he takes, because there's also the prosthetics.
No,
specifically on the face mask, right?
Yeah.
They use it for specific moments where they're, like, emoting it just a little bit.
Right.
And, I think it works, too. Because it does give you a little bit more reference instead of just a flat face mask.
Mm-hmm. And you do have a lot of funny side performances in here, like TJ Miller.
Yeah.
Who gets to be TJ Miller.
Right.
And he's, you know, he actually spars, as far as one-liners go, he spars pretty heavily with Reynolds. And I would imagine that a lot of those sequences between the two are heavily ad-libbed.
Yeah, there's a lot of, this movie in general, I know they've said that it's there's a lot of improv going on. So I know that TJ Miller is a guy that does that a lot anyway. So
yeah, I think he actually refuses to learn the scripts of the movies he's in.
That might be a thing. Well, that might be a thing too when he was having a brain tumor. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah. He's kind of a crazy dude, but but I think when he's on and he works, he works.
Yeah, and he's really good in this movie as being, you know, just a comedic side character. And, you know, there's a lot going on in here that you would think would be tonally difficult because it is very, very violent.
Mm-hmm.
It is also kind of a superhero movie, and it's, you know, in the Marvel comic book universe. So there is, like, is this for kids? I don't know. And then there's also all this stuff about, like, cancer and dying. So the fact that it can find any sort of balance between all of those tones is sort of incredible.
Yeah, the dark humor works. I think it goes with the actors, their sensibilities, and also, you know, bringing in Rhett Reese and Paul Rennick. I think that that was a good duo to bring in to do a script treatment.
Yeah. And if you noticed in the opening credits, so they have kind of a funny self-referential thing where instead of giving actual names, they just say like the comedic side character, the angsty teen,
right,
the old wise lady.
Well, they do. Everybody keeps comparing it to the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Well,
that intro, and it has a pretty elaborate, funny intro. It really does.
Right. I thought of Fight Club. Actually, the intro to that.
Oh. Similar, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and a Fincher movie as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I recommend this movie. I can't say that I was over the moon about it. I was glad that it was tolerable.
I
enjoyed it for what it was.
I think it's good, and I think it plays bigger just because, like I said, it has a lot more personality, and it goes there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about it standing it on the side with like something like Ant-Man.
Mm-hmm.
Where they give a weird kind of, I liked Ant-Man, I should say that. But one thing that was like kind of glaring to me in that movie was the fact that he's supposed to be this bank robber, but then they give him this weird, like heroic bank robber kind of tell. And it's like, you don't really have to do that. Like, yes, it's superhero, but I mean, your protagonist doesn't always have to be a moral like standing point.
Right,
and
right,
so,
right.
Specifically with superheroes, I think that gets really twisted because there's a lot of vigilantes, there's a lot of scope. And also, like, what I was thinking too when I made the Colossus comments, one of the things I was thinking, this could be an interesting thing if they did this. I doubt they would with the studio, but to look at this as POV versus tone.
Yeah.
Because this movie is through Deadpool's point of view. And so therefore, that's why you can do the jokes. You can, you know, bring in those things. You can talk about whether there was a joke in there where they say they're going to bring him back to the professor. And he says, are you bringing him back to Stewart? Or are you bringing it back to
McAvoy?
Yeah. I mean, some of the humor I feel is really witty. And I feel like you either know by this point whether you like superhero movies or not. So this really, the only parameter for this is if you like kind of dark, maybe violent humor. That's it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only separation. But again, I like this one. I think it has a lot of personality. And I think going forward, they even tell you that they had a lot of budget constraints. I think it will be interesting to see where it goes going forward.
Mm-hmm. I could possibly be down to see more of these movies. I don't want to go crazy with it. You know, like, Deadpool gets weird sometimes in the comics. Like, sometimes it gets so meta, it starts to, like, fold in on itself. And then all of a sudden you have, like, Deadpool, Winnie the Pooh, and it just gets weirder and weirder and weirder. Like, I don't necessarily need that.
No, you want a good balance of the fourth wall breaking. Like, I thought that this, like, I've seen a ton of articles saying what they should do for the sequel because they've already announced it through the movie. The fourth wall where that's at, just keep it there.
Right.
It was a good balance.
Yeah. It's not something in general, I would say, not just for this movie, but in general, that's something you want to use sparingly. It's not a joke you want to overplay or else it can get super obnoxious really fast.
And this movie lends to it, and it's, and the character has that built in. But I even thought the, whatchamacallit, the fourth wall break within the fourth wall break.
That was funny.
That was fun. Like, yeah. They need to be there for a specific reason and be there for a fun reason. That's all I really care about. If it's just, you know, because that's the character, well, let's hope that they bring back a competent team to do this. And you know what? People like Tim Miller, who do have kind of a
action
background, I think are well suited for these kind of films.
Yeah, well, I mean, he was for this. I don't think he has a big enough career for me to say anything about what he can and can't do.
That's probably true.
But this worked here.
Well, I guess specifically what I was thinking about is there's kind of a fight believability that has to happen when you're doing set pieces. Mm-hmm. And it is all believable.
And it doesn't skim on that. You know, as heightened as everything is and as jokey as everything is, the fight sequences do exist on their own to be satisfying set pieces.
Right.
And that's important for this type of movie. And I was also, you know, wanting to wrap it up a little bit, but I was also kind of just happy that this wasn't too high stakes. You know, they didn't have to save the world. They didn't have to save the city.
Right.
They did have to save a damsel in distress, which I was a little kind of like, okay, did we have to do that with the plot? But oh well. But I like that the movie is contained within the personal story of Wade Wilson, Deadpool, and it never gets a lot bigger than that, even as they fold in X-Men characters and that kind of stuff.
No, agreed. We don't need everything to blow up in her face. The damsel in distress, I kind of shrugged at because, there's tons of that everywhere. I don't know.
Right. It's an easy writing device. I just wish they'd chosen something a little more creative, but...
I didn't care about that much. I didn't think it was, like, necessarily, like, too overtly misogynist or anything like that.
No, it's not even necessarily a misogynist thing, because this movie makes no bones about, you know, being made for 14-year-old boys anyway.
Yeah.
I was more specifically just laziness.
It's a classic trope. I don't think it's always... this is neither here or there. It's just... it definitely is a damsel in distress, so if that bugs you, it's there. like I said, I that's also something I've heard from people from the internet sphere that they want the set pieces to be bigger. And I was like, please, we don't need everything.
I thought it was pitched just fine.
Yeah.
In fact, if anything, I would like to see more superhero movies more on this level. I know you weren't as big of a fan of it, and it certainly is not without its problems, but I think both the second Wolverine movie and this one were at a really comfortable level, and it tried to stay within the world of the character without, like, pulling in everything.
Yeah, I mean, just to, because you brought it up, there's one reason why I'm not really crazy about the Wolverine, but if we're talking about the level that it's setting at, yeah, that's perfect. It doesn't need to be over the top apocalyptic death kind of.
It doesn't have to be the end of the world or, you know, saving the city from a nuclear catastrophe every episode. Like, look at the success Marvel's had with their Jessica Jones and Daredevil stories, which are more street level and more specific to those neighborhoods.
It's about gentrification and some street level crime. Right. A hallway, beating some people up in a hallway. That's it. That's all it's got to be.
All right, let's go ahead and move on to the Netflix homework now.
Okay.
And I'll let you set that up.
This is an made-for-ESPN documentary. It's basically, it goes into the... it kind of breaks down bit by bit how professional athletes go broke and why they keep going broke in such high statistical numbers. Now, they kind of start you off with the obvious things, like, oh, sports people, they bring in a lot of money. Sports companies, they make a shit ton of revenue, like absurd amounts of money. And so when you compare that to how much these actual athletes are making, it's you kind of go, huh, that gives you a little bit of pause. But then it goes into the story and it shows you that, you know, these people are being irresponsible with their money. And there's some cultural things that don't make, you know, that kind of lead them to kind of going broke. But then it starts breaking it down more and showing you the more and more in depth of how they're being screwed, you know, by either family, by baby mamas, by the
financial advisors,
yes, yeah. Lawyers. And so you have all these people coming at 22-year-old kids, you know, that, you know, kind of have a lot of money. And when they talk about these absurd amounts of money and how much they're spending, I'm just like, who's getting all this money?
Yeah.
So this is kind of like, I mean, you could say this is almost like kind of a micro of kind of a micro version of just our economy in general.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's good that they kind of go into that. It's not just, you know, there is kind of a personal responsibility. People spend their money poorly. These athletes certainly are not spending their money wisely in some cases. However, the system, if they're out to lose from the system from the get-go. And it's funny to see how the financial situation, how when it dropped off in 2008, how much it affected these guys, just like it did everybody else.
Right.
And it also points out that, you know, you're pointing to the top tier, you know, people who are making money, not the bottom tier people.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the bottom tier, you know, they still have all that stuff stacked against them. They just aren't going to be in the news because they're not the top tier. So I think that this actually, for like a kind of TV documentary, I think really breaks down the situation in kind of in a nice way. And they do it in a well presented movie length format. And I liked seeing the breakdown, and I liked them seem going into the different facets and being very specific. What did you think about 30 for 30 Broke?
I would agree. With pretty much everything you said there, I think it's a good look into a specific world, a specific situation, because you hear about this sometimes, but you don't. It's always kind of brushed under, you know. And funnily enough, I watched a documentary. I think it was an A&E documentary or something like that, or an E Channel documentary a long time ago about people who win the lottery, and the same thing kind of happens to them.
Right.
Like there's, you know, famously a lot of lottery winners end up going bankrupt or having terrible things happen to them for most of the same reasons we see here, which is that, absolutely, you know, these are people who've been broke their entire lives. And then all of a sudden they are, you know, overnight millionaires and they go crazy with their money. They have no sense of how to spend money. They have no sense of how to be in a top bracket of the economic scale. And they start going crazy and buying yachts and, you know, buying restaurants and all of these kind of irresponsible different investments that they're sort of tricked into putting their money in. And then all of a sudden it all just starts to fold out from under them one by one by one.
Even getting into like some of the specifics, I mean, like they brought up the point that like, 1 in 40 restaurants, that's how often a restaurant makes it.
Yeah.
And that's one of the best places you can put your finances, one of the better businesses. That's horrifying. And we talk about capitalism working. the fact that it's hard to even get that started. So, I mean, it does show you capitalism is built for you to spend your money. And if you have a lot of it, there's a lot of avenues to do that. And it does take some savvy and some just education to be able to do that. What's funny to me is like when you saw, like they brought up some of the stars and how much they could be making, but then they're like, no, I'm going to do my daytime job so that I can feed my family.
Right.
It does break it down in a very kind of... I think why this gets swept under the rug is because you go, oh, poor them, these rich millionaires.
Right, exactly. It's a I think most people kind of look at it as a personal responsibility story, and they don't think about the other facets of it, which I have to say, the first half of the movie, I was kind of there. I was kind of like, well, yeah, you buy boats and yeah. multiple cars and that kind of stuff, and then you blow your knee out when you're 25 years old. Like, what do you expect? But then later when they went into the, especially when they talk about these, you know, sharky loan advisors and that kind of stuff, or these financial advisors who basically trick these kids into padding their own wallets.
Or family.
Yeah. Like I could definitely see that being a big thing because, you know, the first thing you want to do.
Or romantic interests and divorce court.
Right. Yeah. It's a more complicated story than I think most people would give people the credit for.
Medical bills also, that was heartbreaking as well.
Oh yeah. Well, when they're blowing their knee or they blow, like all the normal kind of injuries that happen to a football player or basketball player is, you know, and it's crazy. It's not a normal person's life.
Well, the drug like pushing as well. I mean, they kind of mention some of these things like very briefly, but then it comes, but you see the full spectrum. And I think the documentary does a very good job of showing that.
Yeah, I would agree. As a documentary, though, as like the form of documentary,
yeah,
there's definitely a TV quality here. For sure. Specifically, it moves really fast.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't let you linger on any one idea for too long. And it definitely has a producer's input in mind of let's keep it going. We don't want to let people be bored. Well, this is an art. This is a TV documentary.
Right.
Let's push on through it here and just hit the talking points.
There's no cinema kind of scenes. There's no kind of pretty like filmmaking.
It's shot a little bit like a commercial. A lot of to the camera stuff. You know, it's not an Errol Morris documentary. Let's just say that.
Right.
I think it gets the job done as far as the story it's trying to tell, and it does a good job at giving those talking points out. I would say that all of these kids who are like coming off of a college draft, this should be like the first thing they make them do is watch this documentary.
Well, something, okay, this is made by ESPN.
Right. This is a series of documentaries they've done, 30 for 30.
Well,
that's, you know, generally well regarded on television.
They hint at it and they talk about it, but they talk all around the fact that a lot of the sports teams don't take care of these kids. They don't do 401k plans for them. They don't, you know, they don't do some basic things that should be that, you know, even like, you know, a silly little employer like McDonald's or Starbucks do.
Right.
I mean, truthfully. So, I mean, at that standpoint, there is a lot of times where I was like, why don't you just say it? The teams. But then I'm like, oh, wait, this is an ESPN documentary. That's
why. Right. Yeah. They can't piss off too many people. Some of the stuff I didn't even know, I thought was fascinating. Like the fact that like tennis players, they're taxed in every country they play in.
Or boxers as well.
Or boxers. That's insane.
Any sports. Yeah. That's yeah. And so when you think about some of these big paychecks, you know, you can see where they're going really quick. And I mean, boxers, they have to pay for a lot of personal training. So I do think that it is fair for people to be like, there is a personal responsibility, but at the same time, there's no net for these guys. And they're basically built into a system to fail. And the fact that these big teams don't try to build something more for these, you know, players is kind of ridiculous. And it's really sad, especially it's funny when you see them glaze over certain numbers and then pinpoint bigger ones, because there is more of a personal responsibility tale kind of being told in a lot of the scenes. But there's a lot of times that you could tell that it was like, well, this is a big deal. We're not going to say names, but yeah. Right. And I mean, specifically, there was when they got into the medical stuff and I was talking about the NFL. Yeah, football is a rough sport. And I know there's a lot of he-men out there. But when you've got some of the biggest and the meanest people like in the nation running at each other full speed. injury happens. And it doesn't matter how big you are, how strong you are, how fast, it doesn't matter. Eventually your body will wear down. There's only so much to it. And so when you see some of the numbers specifically, you know, of these guys that aren't being paid in the millions, that are getting paid in, you know, the tens of thousands to do this job, it kind of makes you think. It makes you go, okay, there should be a union or something for these guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stories we're seeing here mostly have to do with these top tier guys or these celebrities, but most of the players do not make that much money. I mean, they make more than you or I ever will in our lives, but they make, you know, what would I think would be considered like the high end of middle class or low end of upper class.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's only for a handful of years, and then they're kind of on their own.
And they have no job experience besides running at people.
Yeah, no job, except for running into each other. Yeah, they have no job experience, and they have no sense of how to spend money or how to save money, and you know, they've lost all their money in bad investments. And yeah, I agree, there probably should be some sort of union.
Well, there should be, or just a system. Like, why? I mean, the fact that this is pointed out through ESPN, like the fact that the NFL, I'm going to assume, still hasn't done anything, that's poor. You can easily point at that and be like, wow, that's where our corporate nation is in general about this kind of stuff. And it is a microcosm of a larger problem. These companies are pulling in ridiculous amounts. They were talking in the trillions.
Mm-hmm.
That's more than our country makes.
Well, Monday Night Football, I think since who knows how long, has consistently always been the most widely watched thing on Mondays ever. Always. Right. It's impossible. Like, if you're programming something for a Monday, you know it's not going to beat Monday Night Football. Right. You have to account for that.
This would be a great pairing with The Big Short or something of that nature.
Yeah, it's similar, and the narrative kind of follows a similar path.
Mm-hmm.
That's for sure.
Absolutely. And also, if you pair this with other things like, I think it was in like John Oliver's kind of stuff on college football and how they rip them off, and other sports within college, it makes you kind of go, okay, interesting.
All right. Well, next week, we're going to be talking about, in our Netflix homework, the Peter Jackson film, Heavenly Creatures. This is before The Lords, before The Rings.
Somewhere between his violence.
Somewhere between his exploitation comedies and his Lord of the Rings big budget stuff. This is a little indie he did for Miramax in the mid-90s, starring Kate Winslet. I haven't seen it, and I always wanted to.
Yeah, I thought it would be we thought it would be a good moment to catch up on it, so.
Sure. And if anybody has anything to say about Heavenly Creatures, 30 for 30 Broke, or Deadpool, or whatever movie it is, I think we're watching The Beavitch next week.
Oh. At first I was like, what are you swearing at me for? And then I was like, oh, yeah.
The Vivitch?
To translate, the witch.
Yeah. If anybody has anything to say about that as well, you can contact us at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. We're also available to contact on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're on Twitter at jabberpodcast. Follow us there. You can also find us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And if you happen to listen to us on those services, please leave us a star rating and a one-sentence review. We are also available on the Zune and Windows Podcast Network, as well as Player.fm and Pocket Cast. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read some of the stuff I've done for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Richard had a blog. It's called rdwally.weebly.com. And be sure to check out Brad's webzine that he does over at Panel and Frame at medium.com/panel-frame. And be sure to check out our friend Leland over at his Olympia-based podcast, dampercast.com. And be sure to check out Rod and Denise over at the Music Request podcast they do here in Los Angeles called The Listening Party. And Patrick, he's out there, and someday he'll be on our show, I promise. And but until he's on it, go ahead and check out Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. He's a busier guy than we are. He does two podcasts.
And he has, like a big people job.
Yeah, he's a grown-up job. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.